Welcome to another episode of GT Radio. Your host, Tina Magnetta. And tonight I have a really great show with a really cool guy, good friend, Mr. Pat Crofts. He's the CEO of Muskogee Creek and River Spirit. Welcome to the show, Pat. How are you, buddy?
I'm very good. Thank you. Good talking with you.
Good, good. Yeah, we just wrapped up GTE. It was pretty crazy, wasn't it? A lot of people there.
It's a great show. It's obviously the biggest gaming show in the world, and the most well attended. So it's always good to get there and see all your old friends. A lot of them you only see maybe once a year.
Yeah. So listen, this is of course everybody's asking this. So let's cut right to it. Tell us exactly what happened, because this is like one of the biggest natural disasters that's happened to a casino in a long time. Tell us a little bit about the flood. Tell us how it happened and what happened after and all that stuff.
Sure. Our flagship property is here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on the banks of the Arkansas River. And we had a very, very wet fall and early summer. And about mid-May, the rain kept coming and coming. And the upstream lakes that were supposed to stop any flooding were already over capacity and just kept raining and raining. And the Corps of Engineers, who operates the upstream dams, had to keep letting water out so the dams weren't breached. And as the water kept coming up and up, obviously the level of the Arkansas River kept coming up, and it went well above the 100-year floodplain. And we got to a point where all of our utilities coming into the building are underground, and we were notified by the power company that we had 4 hours to evacuate the casino, evacuate the hotel tower, and evacuate all of our employees, because we were going to be without power. So we did have to do the evacuation, and we were shut down for 30 days. And the water did come into the lower levels of the casino. There were some spectacular photos all over the news media. National news media came out here, Today Show and some of the others, and these shots of the Arkansas River completely surrounding our beautiful glass hotel tower and our casino. Our parking lots were all underwater, and we got a lot of national attention because of that, but also we made the decision to pay all of our employees all during the closure. At the time we made that decision, we didn't know if we were going to be closed 6 days or 6 weeks or 6 months, but we decided to do that. And as I mentioned, we were closed for 30 days. We had three remediation companies on site. Once the water went down, and we're able to, as I mentioned, reopen, but the three remediation companies, they were on site 24/7, and many days over the 24-hour period, we would have over 500 workers working on remediating and getting us back open. But we did get back open after 30 days. We had a lot of happy employees and even happier guests that they could start coming back to our facility, and all ended well. We've been back in business, and doing well since. But it was quite an event, and like I say, one of the major disasters, included a casino resort, casino property. But we're back in business. We're doing well, and like I say, things are good now.
That's great. Congratulations. I mean, 500 people working on the remediation. Wow, that's a lot of people. And how many people were in the building at the time that you had have to evacuate? That must have been incredible evacuation.
We have 1,600 employees that work here at the facility. Not all of them were on a shift at the same time, but we have a Margaritaville, restaurant and operation here. We also have a Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, and they were all staffed. So there were probably nearly between 750 and 1,000 employees, and our hotel was probably nearly full. So if you have 500 rooms, say two people a room, that's another 1,000 people. In any time, in any given time in our casino, there's probably a couple of 1,000 people coming through. So all in all, 3,000 or 4,000 people had to be evacuated in a four-hour period.
Unbelievable. Yeah, incredible. And I mean, what a what a sign of kindness for the tribe to pay for the employees for the entire 30 days.
Right. Like I said, we didn't know if it was how long it was going to be, but we just made the commitment that we were going to pay. Not only did we pay all of our employees their full, you know, paychecks, but we also maintained all of their benefits, their health care, and all the other benefits were maintained all during the closure period.
Now, Pat, how long have you been with the tribe?
I've been an employee since 2011. For 3 years prior to that, I was working with the tribe as an outside consultant. I was working with Larry Wolf and Navigante Group, and we helped the Muscogee Creek Nation do phase one of the River Spirit Casino, which opened in 2009. And after that opening, the tribe, I guess you can say, they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And I went to work for the tribe in 2011 as their CEO of the gaming properties.
That's great. Fantastic. That's fantastic. Yeah, you guys have done a great job. Now, we were talking earlier before we came on the show. This is the biggest natural disaster, but there was also another man-made disaster that you were involved with in the early 80s that maybe some of our younger audience might not know, but it was at Hardee's, right? And you were involved with that, and there was a bomb involved. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Back in the early 80s, I was working actually for Harrah's Tahoe at the time, and Harvey's is also at Lake Tahoe in Nevada. And Harvey's had a customer that owed a bunch of money on credit, and they were trying to get him to pay. And, of course, he didn't want to pay, and he got mad at him. And so he and his sons made a bomb and disguised it as a copy machine and delivered it one day to the business office at Harvey's at Lake Tahoe. And they took it up to the second floor business offices and installed it and plugged it in and called in an extortion either later that day or the next day and demanded, I don't know, $1 million or $2 million or something. And they said if they wouldn't pay it, that there was a bomb had been, you know, set in the building and it would go off if they didn't pay it by a certain time. And Harvey Gross, who owned Harvey's at the time, actually tried to pay the ransom. It was supposed to go out, you know, somewhere out in the wilderness near Lake Tahoe and drop a bag of money. You know, obviously it had a locator device in it so they could catch the extortionist, but he never showed up to get the money, and obviously figured out that, you know, he had contacted the FBI, and so there was no more contact made, and so the bomb squads had to come in and, you know, look at the device, and it was definitely going to go off. Luckily, it was in a building that had an outside wall. And so ultimately they sandbagged three sides of the room and opened up the windows on the other side and deliberately set the bomb off. Well, the bomb literally destroyed most of the casino, obviously all of the second floor, a lot of hotel rooms, and it shut the casino down for a long time.
Wow.
It was very, very, very serious. I mean, it was shut down for months and months. And,
that's wild. What a story.
Yeah, so anyway, that was wild. I worked at Harrah's across the street, and we knew when they were going to set it off, so we, you know, put plywood up, evacuated our building also, and, you know, the windows and everything were you know, covered up with plywood, and it was the whole South Lake Tahoe was evacuated, you know, at the casino court, South Lake Tahoe was evacuated, and when the bomb was set off, they did ultimately catch the guy. They found out who he was, that he had owed money, and exactly what happened. But that was quite a disaster back then. I think it was probably 1981 or 82, right along that time frame.
And then they went back to rebuild it, right? They redid the whole place, right?
Right. They obviously had insurance. So once the insurance cleared, and they got approval from the TRPA, the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. They put up a beautiful 700-room tower. It's really a gorgeous facility, and I was hired when they started getting the financing and building the, you know, rebuilding the property up there. I think I went to work for them in 1980, probably about 1983. So the bomb would have been in, like, say, 81 or 82. But, yeah, Harvey's is a beautiful property at Lake Tahoe. It subsequently was sold to Harrah's, but it was an ugly thing, the bombing and the evacuations and the remodel and remediation and repair. But it came out of the ruin to be one of the nicest properties at Lake Tahoe.
Yeah, at the end of it. Great. Well, yeah, great stories. A lot of our listeners probably don't know anything like that. But, yeah, there have been some disasters in the casino business, too. And also, of course, the terrible thing that happened in Vegas. So let's talk a little bit about your history. You come from an interesting background. Tell us a little bit about where you're from and what your family was like and some of the aspirations you had growing up.
Sure. I was born and grew up in a small community in southern Utah. My family was in the logging and lumber business, so I lived in the summer months for the first few years of my life. I lived up in a logging camp in the Rocky Mountains of southern Utah. I lived in a small community, went to high school, small community, and then I went to college also in Utah. And that's how I ended up in the gaming business. Is I was at a on-campus recruiting by one of the then big eight CPA firms, and they offered me a job, and they said we'd like to hire you. We have openings in our Los Angeles office and in our Las Vegas office. Do you have any preference? And I go, yeah, let me think about that. I'm 21 years old and I'm single. How about Las Vegas?
That's funny, Ben.
So they hired me, and I went to work, a 21-year-old single guy in Las Vegas. And I was immediately, you know, their primary client of this big eight CPA firm was Howard Hughes in the Hughes Land and Casino Empire. Howard Hughes owned, I don't know, between 12 and 15, maybe more casinos at the time. And yeah, even though we had other clients, I spent pretty much all of my time, you know, in and around, you know, casinos. And the ones that weren't Howard Hughes, you know, this firm back then, the name was Haskins and Sells, and it became Deloitte Haskins and Sells. Now they're just Deloitte. But anyway, Hughes Tooley and Hughes Empire called Summa Corporation were their largest clients. So I really spent a lot of time around the casinos and just really fell in love with the business and the industry. It's not just casinos. It's hotels and bars and restaurants and golf courses and RV parks and everything. And it was just an amazing business. And that was that was 1973, over 40 years ago. And
wow,
I've been associated and in the gaming business ever since. I just can't get excited about any other industry. It's just been really good for me, and I really enjoy coming to work every day still.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, sometimes you wonder, people saying, that's a business?
Yeah, really. Yeah, some people have a hard time thinking it's actually work. Going to work in a casino.
Yeah. Every time we tell our friends, so we're going to Vegas. Oh, they go, have a good time. No, we're going to work. We're going to have a good time. Come on, you're going to go. You're going to have a party, right? You know, they can't get their hands around it. You know,
right?
Your roots were in accounting, though, right?
Right. I graduated with
a
degree. I had a double major in accounting and finance, and that's how I got in with the CPA firm as my accounting degree.
Because
I went to work for you know, in Las Vegas for the CPA firm, but one of Howard Hughes casinos was in Reno, Nevada, and I was fortunate enough to be assigned to that engagement a couple of 3 years, and I really fell in love with Reno and Lake Tahoe. and I got to
Yeah.
know some people at Harrah's up in Reno, and I was offered a job to go to work for Harrah's in their internal audit department, and I went to work there in 1986, I guess it was, or 1976, I'm sorry. I went to work for Harrah's up in Lake Tahoe.
That's great. So tell us a little bit, what was it like in Vegas back then?
Well, it was a different world. I lived at the time at what people thought was the outskirts of town, which was Charleston and Decatur Boulevard, which anymore anybody that knows Las Vegas, that's like downtown. But the
Yeah.
west of Decatur Boulevard was desert, and there were probably back then when I lived there maybe 250,000 people or so that permanent residents in Las Vegas. And it was back in the days where Howard Hughes came in, and he was helping get rid of organized crime in Las Vegas. As they were revoking gaming licenses, they had Howard Hughes waiting in the wings to take over and buy the casinos and operate them as legitimate businesses. But there
Wow.
were, back in the day, I didn't see it personally, but I understand that people would get caught cheating, they would get their fingers broken, and
Yeah.
if people that were out of control and rowdy, they might get roughed up a little by casino security. But that's just the way, I think that's just the way things were done back then.
Yeah.
It was not quite as it was before corporate America took over gaming. Bill Harrah, I think Harrah's was the first publicly traded gaming company. I know it was for sure the first five-star hotel property in Nevada, but it was public back when I went to work for them, but it hadn't been public very long. But it's a little different now. There weren't nearly as many people. There was, the old downtown Las Vegas and some of the original strip properties, but there was space between them. But it's Las Vegas has certainly
Yeah.
grown up then.
Yeah. So you started with Harris, right?
Right, after the CPA firm that I worked for, I went to work for Harrah's, and back when I went to work for him, it was just Harrah's Reno and Harrah's Lake Tahoe. Then they bought the Holiday Inn and turned it to Harrah's Las Vegas, and then Atlantic City started popping, and so we went back and established Harrah's Marina in Atlantic City, and Harrah's just it just kept getting bigger and bigger. But I left. I left to go to work for Harvey's in 1983. But working for Harrah's, it met a lot of people. It's a great organization. As I mentioned, it was at the time probably one of the only publicly traded companies. And Bill Harrah really knew how to do things right and treat his people right and treat the customers right. So it was a great learning experience working for Harrah's.
Let's talk a little bit about that because you hear so much about the Harrah's name and, all the innovation and first publicly traded company, first, rewards program. You were right there in the middle of it. Tell us what was so special about Bill Harrah and his team.
Well, Bill Harrah was he had an eye for nice things, and there couldn't be a speck of dirt on the floor. If there was, he would walk through a casino, and there better not be a light out in the ceiling. There better not be a smudge, on any paint. There better not be anything dirty or not spick and span. He was very, very meticulous and very particular, and he wanted to be, number one, the very best casino operation, in the state, and I think he was back at that time. He had a really good team of people that worked for him, and like I mentioned, Harrah's Lake Tahoe, when he built it was purpose built to be a five-star, five-diamond hotel, which it was right off the bat. And he was very, very proud of that. He was also known to be he was kind of a thrill seeker. One of the best jobs you could have if you worked for Harrah's back then was one of his bodyguards, because he liked to drive fast. He liked to have fast airplanes. He liked to have fast boats. But his bodyguards all had Ferraris as their car so they could keep up with him when he drove the roads of Nevada, which had no speed limits. So everybody was very envious of his bodyguards.
Wow, that's amazing. Never knew that story. That's a great story. So the evolution has been incredible from then until now. It's just a different, what a curve that's been.
Right. Yeah. Well, Bill Hare died in 1976, and to pay the estate taxes, they had to put the company up for sale, and Holiday Inns out of Memphis, Tennessee, bought Hare's back then. And they had a little bit different philosophy than Bill Hare did, and things did change substantially after that. I mean, Holiday Inns, you know, let Harris kind of run things by themselves for quite a while, but there was a transition. I was actually one of the first people that went from a Harris employee to a Holiday Inn employee. At the time, I was the director of internal audit for Harris Hotels and Casinos, and had some people show up at my office one day and said, "Congratulations, you've been promoted." And I go, "Really?" And they go, "Yeah, you're now the director of internal audit and compliance for Holiday Inns for their casino division. And we'll need you to move to Memphis, Tennessee, and become part of the corporate office there." I did have an apartment there. I never really moved there. I just traveled back and forth between Reno, Tahoe, Las Vegas, and Atlantic City all the time. But I was actually a Holiday Inn employee for a number of years, but it was a change for sure.
Yeah, different kind of mentality.
Yeah, that was.
What do you attribute your success to? What does it take to climb the ladder?
Well, I think you've just got to, you know, be persistent. You know, stay as current as you can on all the technology. Really just pay attention to detail. And a lot of it is, even when I was with the CPA firm and even after I was in the finance department originally at Harris, I was fortunate in the audit department. We did a lot of operational audits as well as financial audits. I got to know all of the different departments, including, you know, the entertainment departments, the construction departments, the food and beverage, the hotel, as well as the casino. So that helped, but always, you know, don't be a 9-to-5 or 5-day-a-week person. I mean, the casino business, weekends and evenings, that's when you're busy. And really just try to broaden your knowledge and what you know about the company as much as possible. You know, don't expect you're going to be hired one year and, you know, be a manager the next year, and a couple of years later you're going to be the CEO. It's not going to happen that way. But, you know, you have to be persistent. Persevere, get, you know, broaden yourself as much as possible, stay current on technology and the industry, and, you know, things will happen. They will if you hang in there.
Yeah, eventually if you work hard and do all the things that you can do and volunteer for any job that's out there, then you'll be climbing pretty fast.
Yeah, people used to ask me why I liked to hang out at the casinos as much as I did when I was supposed to be, you know, in normally off hours. But I just really enjoyed it. It was always fascinating, and you know, I 40 years later, I sometimes think I've seen it all and heard it all, but I haven't. There's something new. Something new will happen about every, if not every day, about once a week. There's something new will come up that you don't think could ever happen, but it does.
Yeah. What's different about the native casino business versus commercials casinos?
Well, primarily is that, you know, tribes are all sovereign nations. They do have their own tribal laws. There are separate tribal regulations. You know, they're similar but a little bit different. The land, you know, getting where you can put casinos in Indian country is very, very highly regulated and not easy to do. And the main thing you got to remember is they are a separate sovereign nation, and they're very proud of that, and they should be. And it probably takes maybe a little longer to get things done. You know, the tribe I work for, they have, you know, the three branches of government, and they have committee meetings and council meetings, and you know, you've got to be able to, you know, go with the flow, I guess. It's not, you know, you can't, it's not like if Bill Hara or Steve Wynn wanted to make a decision and change something tomorrow, it generally doesn't happen that quickly in tribal gaming. If you see a site you think would be a great place to put a casino, you just can't run out there and you know, build one. There's a long process. So just, you know, you've got to be patient, and you have to be very respectful of the tribe and their culture. And in most cases, you've got to remember too that the casinos are the economic engine of the tribes. It's the, you know, probably the biggest moneymaker. Tribes that are fortunate enough to have casinos, it's probably their largest revenue stream. And you've got to be, you know, you've got to be careful with the tribe's money and be a good custodian of their assets and their money.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What was your first Native American casino, and how was that transition for you from commercial to Native gaming?
Well, my first exposure to tribal gaming, I worked for a guy named Fred Gilman, American Heritage Inc., and he was one of the early starters of gaming in California when they had those so-called gray market machines, you know, when there was a big, you know, whether or not they're bingo games or non-bingo games and class two and all that. So, but I work with Fred, and he had a number of casino operations in California. We got a big project in New Mexico, the Route 66 casino. I worked on that project. We helped do the financing and get it built and get it operating. And so, and then with Larry Wolf, he also had some tribal clients with Navigante, and that's how I ended up here. As I was working for Larry, Navigante Group, and the Muscogee Creek Nation was trying to build a big new casino in Tulsa, and we ended up getting hired to help them get financing and, you know, get their construction project together, and, you know, answer all the questions about how much it's going to cost and how you're going to operate it and how you're going to manage it and market it. And so my first full-time job with the tribe was the one I hold right now, which is with the Muscogee Creek Nations. I did consulting work for a number of years that included tribal gaming, but I've only really had one actual, you know, job with the tribe, and that's my current job.
That's great. Fantastic. Tell me a little bit about what's happening right now. There's some stuff going on with the compact, right, in Oklahoma. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, there's a major issue brewing right now. We have a new governor, and one of his campaign promises to look at everything going on in the state and all of their contracts and agreements. And one of the ones that he was looking at is the current state compact with all of the gaming tribes here, and he looked at it, and he thinks that the tribes should all be paying a higher percentage in compact fees. And the issue is the compacts were signed 15 years ago, and the tribes and the tribes' attorneys all read the compacts is that they automatically renew for another 15 years on January 1st of 2020. The governor and apparently his legal advisors don't agree with that, and so he's attempting to, you know, open up negotiations. I think the compact language, if the tribes ask to open up compact negotiations, you know, they can, or, you know, if there's a mutual agreement to renegotiate the compact and, you know, change it, you know, that's fine, but the tribes aren't looking to do that right now. We would obviously like to, you know, add sports betting and, you know, house bank table games where we don't have to charge ante and stuff like that. But the obvious issue is the governor came out first thing that he brought up was that the tribes here in Oklahoma are paying too low of a compact fee. And most of our revenue is on, you know, electronic gaming machines. And There's a lot of tribes here. It's there's a, what a, over 130 casinos in the state of Oklahoma. It's not like a lot of states where there might be a handful or maybe a couple of dozen. There's I think the only state that's got more casinos than Oklahoma is the state of Nevada. So the law of, you know, economics, you can't charge a real high fee. It's not a gaming tax. It's illegal to tax tribes,
yeah.
But it's a exclusivity fee negotiated in the compact, and there's just a lot of money at stake here, and it's a stalemate right now. The governor thinks that the compacts don't renew, and the tribes all feel strongly that the compacts do automatically renew, and I guess there's kind of a showdown coming up sometime between now and January 1st, and we don't know what's going to happen at this point in time. I don't think the tribes are going to change their stance, and it doesn't sound like the governor is at this point in time. So don't know what the resolution will be.
Has that affected expansion decisions and reno decisions?
I've heard a little talk about that. I mean, you know, everybody would like to have it settled. Our banks, you know, our lenders ask us about it all the time. We're not out looking for money right now, but there are a couple of expansion projects going on in Oklahoma now, down on the Texas border. I had heard some time ago that one of them might have been slowed down or stopped, but I guess that's not true. I think they're going forward with it. But I think it gives everybody pause. It certainly gives the people that are going to lend to us, whether you're, you know, they're right now our compact fee percent tops out at 6% on table on electronic games and 10% on table games, and you know, if that were to increase substantially, that would make a lot of difference in borrowing capacity and whether tribes could borrow for more expansion. So it is a major concern. I think people are, you know, kind of waiting to see before they announce any new projects or what will ultimately happen here.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it'll take time, right? Just to see what the thing is.
Right.
You see any red flags for native gaming in the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, I'm in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
I think we just, you know, just talking about the compact. I mean, that could be a big, mm-hmm. you know, that could be a big red flag. I mean, obviously, if Texas were to legalize gaming, that would be pretty big red flag for the state of Oklahoma, particularly the tribes that operate down along the border. There has been a small expansion of gaming nearby in Arkansas. But, you know, really, I think it's just, you know, kind of the natural natural order of things. If, you know, there is going to be more competition coming along. The biggest one for the state of Oklahoma, of course, would be if Texas were to legalize. I've been in the gaming business for 40 years, and I've heard that Texas is going to legalize gaming for 40 years, and it's never happened, so I'm not sure it's going to.
Yeah, that would be another big one. How about nationally? Is it different nationally or the same thing?
I think it's kind of the same thing. There's been a huge expansion of gaming, not just tribal. You know, for a long time in the business, we had Nevada and Atlantic City, and then of course riverboat gaming came along, and then tribal gaming came along, and you know, states are all hurting financially. They're all looking for other revenue sources. So you've seen, you know, legalized gaming pop up all over, and I think more and more, it's becoming a bit of a crowded field. If you can find a good area and have a good market area, you'll probably do all right. But at some point in time, there's got to be a saturation point at some time. I know, like Atlantic City, I talked about that. You know, it made a lot of money, and then, you know, Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun, that occurred. You know, and then all over Pennsylvania and New York, and you know, Atlantic City is suffering now, and you know, there's been a lot of closures there. And in Nevada, particularly in northern Nevada, when tribal gaming happened in California, it certainly hurt them there. They seem to have rebounded pretty good now, particularly mm-hmm. up in Reno. It's just, you know, I guess the law of supply and demand, and but it's just it's that's kind of natural. That's part of business and the business cycle. And that's one of the reasons if you are in operations, you have to be like Bill Harry. You've got to pay attention to detail and take care of your customers and take care of your employees, because there's someone knocking at the door all the time, looking to get into your backyard and get in your market.
That's right, there is. What is your advice to young people coming up through the ranks?
I think the main thing would be patience. I mean, you can kind of hit on this before, but be patient, broaden yourself as much as you can, learn everything you can, and don't expect you're going to be promoted, every year to a bigger and bigger position. But keep current, be patient, and just broaden your knowledge as much as you can. And another thing is, you learn a lot more listening than you do talking. And so don't listen and learn as much as you can, and join the conversation. Don't be too introverted that you don't join the conversation. But there's a lot of great mentors out there and people you can learn from. I learned a lot. I worked with Ed Stevenson a long time. I work with Tom Uterbity at Lake Tahoe. I work with Larry Wolf and people at Navigante Group, and you can learn something from all of them. There are great people out there with great knowledge and kind of teach you how you should conduct yourself, in the business world and also in your personal life to a certain extent also. But look for a mentor, look for the bright people. You can tell the bright ones, and get to know them and listen to them.
Where do you see the opportunity for growth in our business?
Well, obviously, sports betting is blowing up right now. I was just at the G2E. There were probably as many courses and booths and stuff about sports betting and internet betting and esports and everything like that. I think there's probably tremendous growth there. A lot of states are getting into it right now. I wish the state of Oklahoma was one of them, but we're not even really having conversations about that at this point in time, because of the stalemate and the compacts. But I think there's tremendous opportunities, and I hope the states don't open it up where it can be, people other than the casino. If the people in the casino business were used to the regulation, and we know how to run gaming, and we know how to, take care of, what needs to be looked after in wagering and payouts and everything like that. But some states are, I think, hooking it up with their lotteries and things like that. But sports betting, obviously, at some point in time, internet betting, that's probably the big growth opportunity.
Yeah, those are kind of the new frontier. But tell me something, I've heard a lot of people say that, sports betting is the lost leader, really make a lot of money out. Is that true?
Well, you can lose money in sports betting just as much as you can make money. I mean, it's very risky. If football season, if certain favorite teams don't cover the point spread, you can be upside down. I know in the state of Mississippi, I read, they were doing really good, and I don't know, a month or two ago, I think they were negative for the month. It just really depends on the outcomes of the games, and that's why there's, the big gaming companies run their own sports books and race books, but a lot of the mid-sized ones, smaller ones, they get with an operator and have someone else come in and operate it. And if you have a bigger operator, they can spread the secret of running a race and sports book is to balance your book, where you have try to get as many bets on one side as you do the other side of any proposition or any game outcome. And if you've got an operator that's got, a dozen or two dozen or three dozen locations, they can do that better than any single operator. I know that from personal experience and being a part owner in a small, medium-sized casino in northern Nevada, where, if the 49ers covered the point spread, we were good. If they didn't, you may be upside down for the entire weekend, not only in your sports book, but it can offset what you can make in your casino. So it's risky. It's a low hold percent. Big volume, a lot of risk. There is some money to be made, but it's a bit risky. It's a lot. There's a lot more, you know, table games and slot machines. You know, there's math behind it. You know, if there's enough plays, the outcome will, you know, get near your theoretical hold percent. But in sports wagering, you know, there's a lot of emotion and things like that involved. And some people will bet their favorite team no matter what the point spread is. So it becomes a little risky.
Are you there? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, I lost you there.
Hello?
For a sec. I was talking,
yeah,
I couldn't hear you.
Yeah.
You had technical dick.
Yeah,
you just dropped out.
I'm not even on
technical error.
I'm
there.
Not even on the belt phone either.
Yeah, there you go. You guys have built, I got to tell you, I've been to the property a couple of times. I just got to tell you this. You guys have built one of the most amazing casinos there. You know, when I was there for the first time, I thought I was stepping into a Vegas casino. Just tell us briefly, what was it like working on the project and then having it open and then having it do so well? Tell us a little bit about that experience for you.
Sure. I mean, it was just a great project. It was the second phase. We had a large 100,000 square foot casino in phase one and a restaurant or two. And the second phase of River Spirit Casino was included a 500 room hotel tower. We were able to attract Margaritaville to come in as a partner. We have a Margaritaville restaurant. We're able to bring Ruth's Chris in as our steakhouse. And it's just a beautiful property. Most people walk into our lobby and they can't believe that we built something this nice, you know, in this location. We have a gorgeous pool deck. It's operated by Margaritaville, but we're in Oklahoma on the banks of the Arkansas River. And if you go down to our pool deck, there are palm trees, there's a swim-up bar, there are private cabanas, poolside restaurant and bar. And people go down there and they say, wow, we can't believe this. I was actually talking to a couple down there this past summer that walked up and said, do you work here? And I go, yeah. And they said, we got to thank you. My husband was stationed in Florida, and he got transferred to Oklahoma. And we were really, really depressed, and we heard about your place, and we came down here, and every time we come to your facility and come down to the pool, we feel like we're back in Florida, because it does look like we're in the Caribbean, South Florida or somewhere.
Yeah.
We get the comments all the time, but it is a beautiful, it's a 27-story glass tower, 500 rooms, 66 of them are suites, and it's just a gorgeous facility. It was fun being on the design team from the very beginning and, you know, helping shape it and getting it built. And what always amazed me is, you know, the architects and people come up with these beautiful renderings. And when this project was done, it looked just like the renderings. In fact, we accused the construction company a couple of times of building from the renderings rather than building from the blueprints and the plans because it looks identical. But it came out very, very, it was a beautiful facility. It's been our first go around. We're four diamond designation. I mean, we've gotten dozens and dozens of accolades and the best of this and the best of that from different magazines and newspapers. And I don't know, last count it was 60 or 80, different awards. Convention center got the venue of the year. I think it's called. That's one of the trade organizations. We were the venue of the year for trade shows and conventions for the state of Oklahoma last year. But it's been, not only physically but financially, it's been a true success. And we're doing well for the Muscogee Creek Nation. And it's been very, very satisfying. It's been one of the funnest projects I've worked on. I've been involved in a lot of them in my career. But this one I was very intimately involved in from the beginning till the opening. And it's I just have to smile and feel pretty good every time I walk in.
Congratulations, Pat. It's really, really something. Beautiful, beautiful casino. Should we take some phone calls?
Sure.
This is Tino Magnetta. Do you have a question for Pat Crops?
Hey, Tino, Pat. This is Jess Martinelli. I've really just enjoyed everything you've been talking about, Pat. I'm actually one of these strange people listening to the show that knows the story about the Harvey's bombing. I found a little factoid about it a while ago, and I researched the hell out of it and couldn't stop because of how unique that story was. So it's pretty cool to hear somebody talk about it.
Yeah, most people, like Tino said, most people forgot about it. It was so many years ago. It was national news back then, but there's a lot of other things that have happened since then. But it was quite a story.
Yeah, something to be a part of. So you said you got to Vegas when you were 21, and that was your first experience with the gaming industry. I was wondering if there were any jobs you had before that kind of gave you an idea of what kind of future you might have, or what kind of industry you were interested in, or just what other jobs you had before you moved to Vegas.
Well, my family grew up in a family business, lumber and logging, and I spent most of my time working, you know, in the businesses, you know, working in the sawmill, working, driving logging trucks, and, you know, doing all that kind of stuff you would do. When I was in college, I did work, you know, I was in finance and accounting. You know, I worked in the internal auditors department at college. But I really didn't have any clue whatsoever I would ever get in the gaming business. I had only been in Las Vegas maybe once or twice in my life. I remember going one spring break, we went to Las Vegas. I think we might have driven through there another time, but in my wildest dreams, I really didn't think I would work in the casino business. That was kind of a pleasant surprise to me when I took a job with a CPA firm expecting to, you know, be an auditor, and they didn't tell me that their primary client was Howard Hughes and that we'd be spending a lot of time in casinos when I took the job. But most of my work before that was just working in the family business and working jobs in college.
Yeah, it's
very
great.
Interesting.
Amazing stuff.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for listening,
Jess.
In.
Take care. Bye. Let me take another caller here. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. Do you have a question or questions for Pat Crops?
Hey, Tino. Hey, Pat. It's Rogelio in North Dakota.
Hey, how are you, buddy?
Good.
Good.
The weather's getting crazy outside right now. It's pouring like cats and dogs, and the wind's probably about 35 miles an hour, so it's getting a little hairy out.
Wow. North Dakota, huh?
Yeah. Pat, got a question. If not, I know you're talking about the negotiation of your, you know, compacts coming up. You talked about sports betting a bit. If not sports betting, what else would you like to see come new to your property, or what would you like to have new to your property? Is there anything else that you'd like to expand on?
Sure. One thing, the enabling legislation for gaming here in Oklahoma said that we can't have house bank card games, so we do operate, you know, blackjack games and things like that, but we have to charge an ante. That's the only revenue the casino gets off of those is the ante. All of the other winning bets go into what's called a players pool, and that money all has to be paid back to players or given away to them in promotions. But when people come and play blackjack or, you know, one of the poker games played on a table, free card poker, whatever, or craps or whatever, to have to put up an ante every time you bet really just is offensive to them, and it's very time consuming. And so if, besides sports betting, if we could get the law changed and get our compacts to allow you know, house bank card games, that would be a major, major plus for us. It was only a year ago we could actually use a roulette wheel and dice to play roulette and craps, because before that, the outcome of the games had to be determined by a deck of cards. So we're fortunate enough that people can actually roll dice and, and use a roulette wheel now, but we still have to charge the ante, and it just, for lack of a better word, it pisses people off. It just,
sure.
just offensive to them. Offensive to them, you know. They're playing, and it's like I said, people playing poker against one another. They understand an ante, but they don't understand if they played blackjack anywhere else. Why do you have to put up an ante to play blackjack?
Do they blame the casino itself, or do most people know that's just how it is in Oklahoma?
No. Most people think we're just gigging them. They just think it's that we're being greedy. And besides them doing because everything else looks like a regular blackjack game, but before every bet we're taking 50 cents or whatever the ante is. And most of them it offends them because they think the casinos are ripping them off.
Right. All right.
But anyway, sports betting and house bank games, we'd love to have. Hopefully, there may be some negotiations with the governor. We get a compact the house bank games. That's not just a compact. That has to be approved by the legislature here. Also, as would sports betting.
Mm-hmm. And what about any non-gaming? Any non-gaming venues you think you would look? I've never been to your casino, but it sounds like you have some good partnership with Margaritaville Restaurant and the other restaurants. But is there any other? Is there any other non-gaming you're looking at?
Well, we bought some property across the street from our casino recently. It's about 30 acres, and we're working with a developer to put in a big mixed-use development, which includes, retail and bars and restaurants and offices and probably some high-end condos. So that's directly across the street.
Nice.
We're always looking to upgrade, our restaurants and bring in new names. The Ruth Chris Steakhouse we have in our property is always one of the top 10 in their chain. Margaritaville is doing very well here. So we have a high-end spa, health club, salon, a pretty good mixture of bars and restaurants. But that's where a lot of the opportunity is really with non-gaming amenities to bring people in.
Me and Tino have to take a visit over there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've been there a couple of times. It's I'm telling you, man. As soon as you walk into the lobby, there's the big screen there. It's really something else, man. I'm telling you, it's really
nice.
Cool.
Sweet.
They've done such
a
great job.
All right. Well, appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in.
For an opportunity.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
Thank you. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. You have a question for Pat Kraft?
Yeah, this is Bobby in Las Vegas. How are you doing, Tino?
Good. How you doing, Bobby?
I'm all right. Pat, I was wanting to ask, as marketing in the casinos changes and it's such a major expense, what are your favorite ways to spend money, and what are the ones that are what are the ones that there are a little tougher decisions to make in this, particularly as it pertains to marketing and promotion of your properties?
Well, the funnest one and the one I like the best is we do have about a 3,000 seat theater here, and booking the entertainment and having the entertainers come in, we have a pretty good lineup of entertainers that come through, and we generally do very well in the casino before and after. But that's probably the funnest part. The most, more exciting would be the entertainment aspect of it. We've gone a lot more to, we do a lot of direct mail marketing, and we're doing an awful lot of social media right now too, relying less and less on, TV and print media and going to, digital and social media. But we do it all. I mean, we spend a significant amount of money every year. We do, besides all the normal stuff, we do at least once a week, we have a player development VIP invitee program where customers come in and we have a big dinner for them in our convention center, and then, give them, giveaways and prizes and things like that. We do a few slot tournaments. So we kind of do it all. Like, the fun one to me though is the entertainment, because we have had and we continue to have some really great entertainers come through here.
It's great. And I was kind of curious, maybe your tribe is less exposed to to the impact of, you know, if gaming were ever legalized in Texas. Can you talk a little bit about how that would disrupt everything in Oklahoma?
Right, and it would be primarily the tribes with the big casinos, and the largest casino in the world, of course, is down on the Texas border on I-35. There's another large one on Highway 69 or 75, whatever.
75.
They would obviously take the biggest brunt of it if Texas were to legalize gaming. our tribe, we're centered in Tulsa, which is up in northeast Oklahoma, and all nine of our casinos are within about 100-mile radius of Tulsa, so we're somewhat insulated. We do get a few customers from Texas. A lot of business people from Texas come up here because of the oil and gas industry. We're just starting, you know, Arkansas just legalized, you know, a couple of casinos and a couple of tracks to do betting. Kansas has limited gaming, and as does Missouri. But Texas, we wouldn't get hurt that bad where we're physically and geographically located. But the tribes down on the border, you know, even though they're only an hour's drive or so from Dallas, I think they would be, you know, the most susceptible to a downturn in business if Texas were to legalize.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure, Tino. Thanks for another great guest.
Yeah, thank you so much. Have a good night.
Thanks.
Okay. Great stuff. All right, I think we got time for one more. Hello, this is Tino Magnetti. You have a question for Pat Cross?
I do, and thanks for taking my call. What do you think is the next wave to impact the casino business like the slot machine did?
The next wave that would do what now?
The next wave of business that would affect the casino business like the slot machine did.
Oh, what something that would be competitive to the casino business?
Yes.
Well, I think everybody's a little bit worried about the millennials. You know, they like to game, and they don't necessarily like to come into a casino to do it. And I think that's why people are hoping that, you know, that the laws change nationally where we can do internet betting. But, the casino, you know, we're all trying to attract millennials more now and get them to come in. But, you know, that new generation, they don't seem to really like or, you know, participate, you know, in brick and mortar gaming, you know, like their parents did and our current customers are. So I think that's probably one of the bigger concerns that I've heard people talking about. And then this, you know, other opportunities and, you know, things to do with their spare time and with their, you know, their money for entertainment value. But like I say, the millennials and the gaming and, you know, doing things online and, you know, they play against one another and it's very competitive and they don't necessarily have to come into a casino and spend a lot of money to do that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. More of a lounge thing. Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Pat, thanks so much for being on the show. It's been absolutely fantastic. I love the stories. We'll have to have you back on.
All right, thank you. All right, good.
Thanks, buddy.
Have
a good time. Yeah, bye-bye.
All right, you too.
Bye. Yeah, bye-bye. Okay, that was great. And so Thursday I have Rogelio Rubio on the show. Great guy. We're going to see his evolution from the last time I spoke to him. Remember, everybody's got a story to tell. You just have to have time to listen. Have a good night. Bye-bye.